3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Because the land to us is the whole thing, right? The land is an ecosystem. It's not real estate.
Blockading is symbolic, but it's also literal, because what you're saying is whatever's being done, it stops here. And it's deadly serious because you're laying your body on the line.
Welcome to Treesets, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR, which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. My name's Ian McIntyre, and today I'm talking with Paul Winstanley about his experiences in carrying out treesets in the Canadian province of British Columbia from the late 1980s to the early 2000s. The first part of the interview focuses on how Canada's first sustained treeset action occurred during the Sulphur Passage blockade of 1988 in Clayoquot Sound, which is located on the west coast of Vancouver Island. This area had seen the country's first anti-logging blockade take place 4 years earlier, when First Nations people and local non-Indigenous environmentalists had successfully prevented Mears Island from being clear-felled. In the midst of ongoing negotiations regarding Aboriginal sovereignty and campaigning against the wholesale destruction of local ecosystems, the Friends of Clayoquot Sound launched another blockade in June 1988. This came after photographer Adrian Dorst discovered landslides in the secluded Sulphur Passage area. Located 27 kilometres from the coastal town of Tofino, these had been caused by blasting for logging road construction. In order to defend this corridor of unlogged habitat and draw media attention to its destruction, various actions were undertaken by blockaders. These included placing themselves in danger by occupying the road and forest in the blasting zone and moving boats and other vessels to points near cliffs where blasting was taking place. Although it was illegal to blast near people or send rocks into the sound, the road builders still did so. Despite these practices, blasting was slowed by the presence of blockaders, as major injuries and deaths would have proven difficult for the logging company to justify. Instead, workers carried out operations up to the point which they deemed was safe. Although no blockader was majorly injured, there were close calls, and some later reported suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. The potential for things to have gone very badly wrong due to the lack of safety precautions was later underlined by the fact that a worker was killed during blasting. Logging company Fletcher Challenge had received the province's most generous injunction to date, in that it banned protesters from coming within 5 kilometres of construction. However, the company found legal threats had minimal effect, even after campaigners were sentenced up to months in jail, including some being sent to maximum security prisons. Taking advantage of the remote location and the lack of constant police and worker presence, activists experimented with new tactical forms. For the first time in British Columbia, tactics such as tree sitting and placing a wicker basket off the side of a cliff were used. Although tree sits had previously been employed in New Zealand, the US and Australia, activists in Clayoquot Sound were unaware of such precedents and developed their own style of getting into trees and remaining there. Following on an earlier tree sit at Sulphur Passage, Paul Winstanley occupied a hammock strung between two trees in August 1988 and stayed there for 3 days. By this point in the campaign, a number of people had already been arrested, which meant that Paul had to maintain the sit on his own. I started out by asking him how he got involved in the blockade whilst visiting the nearby town of Tofino.
I was there on a business trip, the light show, but I went on a trip to Mears Island and I had an epiphany, and that's what made me decide to climb the tree.
Can you tell us about the previous tree sit Adrian Dorst had done and then how the idea came about to use a hammock this time?
He climbed up a tree, bear climbed up a tree and sat on a branch for a number of hours, and then someone came up with the idea, well, because they were at a huge rock, a bluff that they had to blast. It was a monster of a blast, and so that was where someone had a wicker chair, and they hung that over the front of that. She, I think, spent one or two, maybe even three nights, I don't know, but they were able, of course, just to get at the rope and then pull her up. So then they thought, okay, well, what about if we slung a hammock? I mean, it was just basically people coming up with, like, well, what do we do next? We weren't looking at any handbook. There was nobody that had any experience. We were winging it. The base camp was outside of the 5 mile injunction area, and that's where people would arrive by boat, and then they would do a 15-minute hike through the bush to get to where the blockade was happening. I wasn't at the base camp very long. I just basically went with Suzanne's husband and the hammock, and went and bear hugged our ways up a couple trees, because the woman that had been in the wicker chair had finally managed to get to her. I don't think that she shared that with anyone else. I think that she was the only person in the wicker chair. But when we ended up getting up to a certain height, say 60 feet or more, it was on a very steep slope. So the trees were very old and very tall, but they weren't very big in circumference. We were able to bear hug the hammock up, and I spent about 2-3 hours setting it all up, thinking that someone else was going to say, okay, it's my turn now, I'm ready to take your place. And that didn't happen. So I just settled in, and it slowly dawned on me that I was it. When I was up there, I stumbled across a technique for climbing the tree, which meant you just take a chunk of rope about 10 feet and you tie it to itself. So now it's a circle, and now you can put it around the tree and through itself, and it becomes a stirrup. You make two of them, and you put one foot in it and hike up, and then you set another one, and then as you put your next foot in there and hike it up, you reach down and you grab the other one and retrieve it to set it up higher. So every time the loggers came, I was about 30 feet higher, because I just spent the time when they were around pulling the hammock up. I'd go up one, take it up 30 feet up one tree, and then climb across, and then go 30 feet up the other tree.
So how did the logging workers react to the fact that you were now stopping them from completing clearing for the road?
Just the very fact that they couldn't get at you in the first place. And then the fact that every time they arrived, I was 30 feet higher, really kind of blew their jets. They really overreacted in terms of the co-owner shooting me with the pellet gun, and then the 7 loggers chopping the trees down. They're not even used to having people out there. Loggers were completely used to, they go out and there's nobody out there. They go out and they do their thing. As soon as people started showing up, let alone sitting on the road, even if you're there and you're watching them, you could be there and with a camera and taking notes, and that would freak them out. If you went up there and you just started leaving things around, like nothing dangerous or anything, but just to show that someone has been here, someone has been at this tree that you're about to cut, because you've left something there for them to see. It's not superstition, and the fact that someone has been there before them or even watching what they're doing, they didn't like that at all. I'm up there, and I'm settling in, and realizing that I'm it. So the loggers were sort of maybe yelling a bit of abuse at me, but I'm trying to talk to them about, like, hey, sorry, da-da-da-da. So I spend one night. And the next day, I'm still there. So they're like, shit, he's still there. And then at some point, I had the opportunity to get it another 30 feet higher. So when they came back later in the afternoon, they started to realize that this is getting even more serious. Drilling was going on. What they had there was the drilling machine, was a drill that was on a Sherman tank chassis. And so the whole time I was in the hammock, it was drilling, and I was completely surrounded by rock dust. So I had a damp handkerchief on my face, pretty nasty. And the other thing they did, they continued to cut trees up top of the bluff. And so a couple of the trees came scarily close to me as they fell, and then they fell across the top of the bluff. So the third day, again, I'm 30 feet higher, and then I had a radio telephone. It was a battery-operated radio telephone, but I wasn't really using it. It was just there for emergencies. But I saw this guy run underneath me, and I looked down at him, and I could see that he had a gun tucked in the back of his pants. And so I had a little disposable camera, and I took a couple shots of that. And then I saw him run up into the bush chasing people, and I was just going, oh, my God, what on earth have I got myself into? It looked like a real gun. I mean, it was a big black gun. So I'm sitting, I'm not in the hammock at that point. What I am is I'm up sitting on a branch with one of my loops that I use for getting further up the tree, just around underneath my shoulder and around the branch. and I feel two really sharp, heavy whack-whacks in my upper thigh, and I just stiffened, and so my just heart was just went, and then two more hit me, and I went, wait a minute, I'm not hearing any bang-bang. So I turned around, and I looked down at him. He's got the gun in both hands and pointing it straight at me, and that kind of freaked me because I thought I was going to get it in the face, so I whipped my face around, and I just was so, this wave of contempt came over me, and I just said to him, I said, you stupid, silly bastard, shoot all you want. I am not coming down. And so he left. Later that day, an orange van came, and it was seven loggers came out, and they had axes, and they started whacking away at my trees. And I'm slowly getting out of my hammock and slowly going like a sloth on the rope up to the tree. And that's when I realized that you couldn't set the loops underneath you. Then I looked over and I noticed that just by coincidence on that day, they had brought a 3/4-inch broadcast quality video camera, and they were videotaping them chopping. They let them do a little bit of that, and then they stood up and they said, hey, look, we're videotaping you. And the loggers went, and like, yikes, and they left. And then my friends went back to the camp. So I settled back into the hammock thinking, okay, it's just another night. I'm just going to spend another night here. And then a company vehicle came, a truck, and two of the white hat company officials came and sort of like, blah, 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 we can't, apologies, a little bit of an apology for their loggers. And, you know, there's nothing we can do about what they do when they're off work, right? They're not our responsibility when they're off work. So they were basically trying to distance themselves from the fact that their loggers had been chopping my tree. They left. It's starting to get dark. And they go around a corner. And as they go around a corner, I see the orange van start to come back. And I went, oh, Christ, here comes those loggers again. And I thought, well, the company guys are going to turn them around. Like, they'll stop them. And so I'm sitting there waiting, and there was enough time that they had some chit-chat. But then, to my horror, here they come, the loggers, and this time they were really pissed, and they were wasting no time getting those trees down. I yelled down at one of them when I realized I couldn't set the climbing loops. You could set them above you and climb higher, but you can't climb down the tree with those climbing loops. You can't set the loop underneath you. You can only set it above you. And that's when I realized that I couldn't get out of the tree. By the time I got myself back up into, again, trying to move like as fast as possible, but like a sloth, because I'm just basically free hanging onto a rope, and the trees are going thud, thud, thud as they're chopping into them. At that height, they were very thin, and even down the base, they were more than 2.5 feet in diameter. But they were pretty tall because it was a pretty intense slope, which meant that when the loggers did get around to chopping the trees down from underneath me and I felt the tree start to go, it would be a long fall down, simply the height of the tree, but down the slope to where all the blasted rock was. So that wasn't a pleasant scenario for me. And I looked down, I yelled down to one of the loggers. I said, are you going to beat me up when I get down? And one of the loggers said, nope. And when I felt the tree start to fall, and I took one of my loops, flipped it around the tree, grabbed it, because I didn't want to just slide down the tree and go, like, fall away from it. I wanted to have some control. So by hanging on to the loop, it allowed me, then I just stepped out of the other one, and then just down I go. I just went wham, down onto the ground, and was really lucky. If I'd come down a little bit to the right, I would have been disemboweled on a nasty snag. So when I did hit the ground, I had my tail between my legs, metaphorically, and went up and shook the guy's hand and said, thank you very much for getting my tree. That's where you're at. Like, you're just in a state of, like, funk. It's not really terror. And now I'm just in a state of shock, and all I want to do is get the hell out of there. It's dark. I'm with Steve Lawson. I'm just like going, I'm finished. I'm sorry. I got to go tomorrow morning. I'm leaving. And he said, look, if you let these guys do that to you and you just leave, then they're going to think they can do that to anybody. And I realized, yeah, well, he's right. So So the next morning when it was light, I shinnied my way out onto one of the trees that was had been felled and was sticking out over the rock that they'd been drilling into. So when the loggers came, I wasn't gone. And so they're going, blah, 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 and they take off. And while I was waiting for the police to come, someone said, the media would like to interview you in Tofino. And then I was hanging around Tofino when I heard that the RCMP had a warrant out for my arrest, and so I turned myself in. And then after they cut my trees down, they stopped. I don't think they even blasted that that rock. Well, I was probably one of the last persons to be there, to be in their face, and I don't think anything happened after that. They packed it in. They did go somewhere else, and they did some logging somewhere else, but that location now is a provincial park.
So what happened with everyone's arrests and your court case in particular?
35 people were arrested, and one of the arrestees, the tribal chieftain, they dropped the charges on him. I defended myself in court. You're basically guilty. So speaking to sentence, I said, presented concept that in my mind, it was equivalent to a house is on fire and I'm breaking the law by kicking the door in to go in to see if there's anybody I can save. I think I got 25 or 30 days in Ocala, which was a 90-year-old classic, 200 prisoners in concrete, in a big monster concrete building with classic cells and all that. And the second night I was in, someone got stabbed one tier above, and I saw the bloody knife hit the floor, and convict came up and wiped it clean and put it down the drain. And that was the only night that it was ever really like what I in my imagination, I thought prison would be like, because they locked everybody up, and so there's 200 prisoners banging and screaming and rattling their cages because they searched everybody. From then on, it was just like it was prison 101. You just learn how to adapt to it. And then it eventually became clear to me that if this is the biggest stick they can hit me with, and the worst part about jail is the admission part where you're going, they put you in a cell by yourself and they just leave you, and then takes forever for them to process you. And that's intentional, just to break you. And that's the hardest part about going to jail is getting into jail. Once you're in jail and there's a routine and you start to learn how to deal with the routine, and luckily I was in there for contempt of court, so the inmates, you know, felt that that was okay. And they had also seen me on CBC get chopped out of the tree, so they thought that was pretty funny. So I was just like getting along well with the inmates. You don't go in there with an attitude. You don't go in there thinking that you're any way special or anything better than them. And they'd already seen me. They knew I was crazy because I was up the tree, got chopped down, and I was affable. I was lucky enough to get a job tier cleaning, and so the inmates were happy with me because I made it really, really nice, neat, and clean. And the guards were happy with me because I made it nice, neat, and clean. So I got along well with everybody. It went reasonably well. I didn't have a problem with jail.
No Pasaran.
No Pasaran. Clackwood.
No Pasaran.
No
Vargas Island.
Come, you bold men of Clackwood, come, you bold women. There is a fire burning on the mountain, the sting of smoke blown in the wind.
Hear the blast of the whistle, hear the snarl of the chain.
Hear the cracking in the heartwood, hear it again and again and again.
No Pasaran,
meet and river.
No Pasaran,
Clackwood River.
No Pasaran, Sulphur Passage.
Valley torn asunder, there's a mountain stripped of bone. Grove of spruce, stand of cedar, the ancient garden, sacked and burned.
Hear the blast of the whistle, hear the snarl of the chain. Hear the crack in the hardwood, hear it again and again.
There is a cry deep within the forest. Hear the whisper in the wind.
Hear the breath in the cedar, sighing in the slough. The beating deep within the forest. The grouse, the thrush, the great horn now.
We'll stand with these cedars, stand in these balsam groves. Stand with the hare and the cougar, the otter. Like a tree by the water, we shall not move.
No passerine.
Come, ye bold women, there's a fire burning on the mountain, the sting of smoke blown in the wind.
Hear the blast of the whistle, hear the snarl of the chain, hear the cracking in the heartwood, hear it again and again and again.
No passerine, Meechin River, no passerine, Blackwood River, no passerine, Flora's Island.
You're listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR, which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. I'm Ian McIntyre, and today I'm chatting with Paul Winstanley about his experiences with tree sitting as part of environmental and First Nations blockades in the Canadian province of British Columbia during the late 1980s and 1990s. Just then we heard a song composed by Bob Boson about the Sulphur Passage blockade entitled No Passerine. Drawn from the Spanish Civil War and Nicaraguan Sandinistas, the slogan No Passerine or They Shall Not Pass was adopted by the blockade. It proved apt, as in late 1988, loggers pulled out of the area and the forest remains intact today. The next campaign against clear felling that Paul took part in was in British Columbia's Lower Sitka Valley. Where we rejoin the conversation, he tells us about his experience of tree sitting during this blockade.
At the Sitka, again, I didn't have a harness. I used a loop method, right, the two loops, and I got up. I went up one side, tied the rope off, came down, and I went up the other side, tied the rope off, and now the hammock was there. This was not for a blasting zone. This was actually on the edge of a clear cut. But when they clear cut, if it's up a slope, they cannot continue to clear cut if you're there at the cutting edge. They can do it maybe some distance away from you, but you create a big blockage for them. But they sent up two loggers with their logging climbing gear, and as they started coming up the trees, I climbed out of the hammock and started up the tree, one of these hemlocks. And when they got to my tree, they cut my hammock down. And that's when I started to realize, God, you can't defend two trees, because with the hammock went all my sleeping bag and everything. But when I climbed to the very top of this hemlock, and the logger, after having cut the hammock down, he's coming up behind me. I'm just kind of thinking, well, what the hell is going to happen when I get to the top of this hemlock? What's he going to do? And I was also looking across at a huge red cedar, and my mind was racing. I'm thinking, well, maybe there's a branch from the red cedar that's going to be, you know, jammed into the hemlock, and I can get into the red cedar. But I also was realizing, no, in high winds, the trees, they prune themselves. So it's not likely going to be a branch that is going to be easy. I knew that was not likely. But the weird thing was, when I got to the top of this hemlock, the very tip of the hemlock was just about the size of my thumb. The biggest branch on that cedar had come all the way over, and it, the very tip of it branch, was sitting on top of that, and it was a green stub too, and it was just sitting on top of it. But when I got to that point, now I don't have a harness, so I just grabbed the tree, which is now about like six inches or less in diameter, with my thighs. I'm just grabbing it, and I grab hold of that cedar branch, and I start pulling myself into it. Hemlock is getting pulled over, and the gut people down below are like going, ooh, and the logger must be wondering what the hell, because the tree is starting to bend over. And I got to a point where now I'm at a fork, and the fork's on about twice the size of my thumb. And I went to hell with it, and I grabbed one part of that fork and the other part of that fork and let go of my legs. And then I just came whoosh, swooshing down out of the tops of the trees, and then scurried up that branch and scurried all the way up to the top of the cedar. And previously I'd been telling the police, like, I'll turn myself in, but you'll have to wait until next Friday. They said, oh, no, we're going to get you. And I said, no, I don't think so. I'll turn myself in next Friday. And then when they saw me get to the top of the cedar, they just said, by bullhorn, I said, okay, we'll see you next Friday. But what happened, and that was mid-November and at altitude, Catherine Creek, the Sitka is Robson Bight. That's where there's the killer whales come in and they rub up on the pebbles on the beach. They really enjoy it. So that was one of the reasons why we were concerned about them logging that might destroy that little bit of habitat. So anyways, I went to the very top of the cedar and sort of pulled together some branches and made myself a little nest. But I didn't have any sleeping bag or any tarp or anything like that. And I was already getting cold. And at that point, there were only three people left in the base camp because the loggers had set up a base camp blocking the road. So there was a huge number of loggers blocking people from getting to the base camp. The base people in the base camp, the three, were so scared they'd left the base camp and scattered. But one person came, and he had a small tarp and a sleeping bag and some warm clothing. And then so when I went from the top of the tree all the way down to that big, huge branch, I tied together all the various scraps of rope I had and was just able to, he was able to tie it to that. And so I pulled it up, the bundle, perched it on that big branch, and then climbed up until I had another 50 feet or so. And that was as much rope as I had, or maybe it was 75 feet, probably 75, because it was a long ways up to that first branch. And then I'd wrap it around my belt, and I'd pull it up, and then perch it on the branch, and then climb up higher. And I did that three times. But the third time, because I was getting hot, already starting to get hypothermic a little bit, I didn't put it through my belt sufficiently, and I fumbled it, and the rope slipped, hit the bundle, and it all fell out and out of the tree. And by that time, my friend had gone, and I went, oh, God. This is it. I'm going to be up here all night. This is not going to be good. And I got so freaking cold that I had to force myself out of my catatonic, like, clutched together state and climb up and down the tree just to get my body heat up. The steep was coming in sideways, and I was freezing. It was a long night. So by the time it got light, I was like, I'm out of here. This is insane. I got to go. There's no way I can continue this. And so I climbed down to the big branch and then went all the way out to the end. And now I could look over there and I could see, oh, there's that, my hemlock. Huh, it's way over there. And there's no way I'm going to be jumping into that because I'm on as far as I can go on this branch. And then no harness. I'm just sort of clutching it like a sloth, right? But I built a little grapnel out of a branch and some rope, and I thought, well, maybe if I, and I thought, well, there's not much chance of this, but I'm going to just try to throw my grapnel and hope to catch that top of that hemlock, and then maybe I can pull it to myself and then jump into it. And I was really lucky, and it did catch it, and I was able to pull it over. This was early, very early in the morning. There was no loggers or police or anybody then, and once I was able to pull it over to the point where I grabbed it, and now I'm hanging on to this cedar, and I'm hanging on to the top of that hemlock, and it's went, and I jumped into it. And then I climbed down in the very last branch with no harness. I also didn't know how to rappel. I was so freaking cold that I just slid down and hit the ground, and I was just like there sobbing in the dirt, like sort of like laugh crying. And then that's when the tree climber buddy came up, and he was going to join me, but I just said, oh God, I'm sorry, I just, no, I am his tree. So I staggered down to the road, and then I was so out of it that I'm walking along the logging road back to the base camp, and when the orange crummy came around quite a distance away, I could have just walked off the road and hidden, but it was like, my mind was just so out of it. I thought, oh, my, great. Oh, yeah, hallelujah.
After you were picked up by the police, what were you charged with?
Civil contempt of court is what we were first charged with at Sulphur Passage. The second time that I was arrested, that was at the Sitka. What they did is they said, okay, because you have media coverage, now it's not civil contempt, now it's criminal contempt, because you are bringing the media coverage, presents it to the public in general, and that's much more serious. Civil contempt, the logging companies have to pay for it. Criminal contempt, the government has to pay for it. And it's a much more serious offense. But from then on, it's always been criminal contempt.
Can you tell us about the training workshops you were running during this time?
University of Victoria, we formed a tree climbing club, and I did what I said were demonstrations. I would go up a tree a certain distance in a location on the campus where there were some nice trees, and I'd say look, I'm telling you right now, do not do this. This is extremely dangerous. I've almost killed myself so many times. I just don't say to you, this is not a good thing to do. However, if you choose to ignore this warning and you're interested in knowing how to do this, then pay close attention and ask lots of questions. Because you see, your thighs can get you up a tree, but if you can't do more than 5 pull-ups, then you're going to fall out of the tree. And actually, one woman who was put up on a platform unprepared, things screwed up, and she fell down the rope and dislodged a vertebrae and had a body cast on for quite some time, lucky she didn't break it completely.
You also took part in the Lilawat blockade of 1991, in which First Nations members opposed logging on their territory. How did the logging company prevent you from successfully carrying out a tree sit here?
If they know that someone's thinking about going up a tree, what they'll do is they'll just cut all the trees down or anywhere near that you could block the actual logging or block a blast zone. It happened to me once at a blockade that where I was at the Lilawat, a native blockade in, I think, 1991 at Lilawat Lake. When I arrived, I made the mistake of climbing a tree right at the beach where the natives were, and someone must have seen that and went, whoa, we have a tree climber, and then next thing you know, boom, they cut a huge swath to prevent anyone from climbing trees. You don't want anyone to know.
During these actions, what sort of dialogue would you have with the loggers?
One of the things that I was certain when I was talking to the loggers on the ground and saying, look, I'm really, really sorry that I'm upsetting you. I'm not angry at you guys, and I'm really sorry that I'm here stopping your work. If I could climb the corporate towers in Vancouver, I'd do that. I just don't know how to do that. All I knew how to do was climb trees, so I'm really sorry. You guys know that what you're doing is not going to last. I'm sorry, you know that. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, like, slow it down to the point where we take a very close look at what we're doing and think ahead, not just think in terms of companies making profits for their shareholders. We've got to be thinking 10 years, 50 years into the future.
On Vancouver Island, forest so old, the last of her kind. She is mighty and bold, but the big blades now are mowing her down. Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. the NDP had made a big noise, trying to play the big games with all the big boys. So they sold out her soul for hardly a cent. The raw timber's cut and elsewhere is sent. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Upwards of thousands have stood in the way, but bullies just come and take them each day. And the government too has its own sauce. They're changing the charges by changing the law. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Live in the trees, and what of the life, the quiet, the breeze, and what of our planet when she's stripped to the ground? Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Blow the bridge down, friends. Blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. When she's stripped to the ground, farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound.
You're listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a summer series on Community Radio 3CR, which looks at the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the US. I'm Ian McIntyre, and today I'm chatting with Paul Winstanley about his experiences with tree sitting as part of environmental and First Nations blockades in the Canadian province of British Columbia from the late 1980s to the early 2000s. Just then we heard a song by the Weird Sisters entitled Farewell to Clackwood Sound, which was written about the huge protests held there in 1993. Opposition to continued clear felling in the area had led to Clackwood Summer, which proved to be Canada's biggest anti-logging campaign. Protests focused on the Kennedy River Bridge, where from July 5 to October 4, blockaders assembled daily. Actions primarily took the same form each morning, with groups occupying the road, injunctions being read by police, and those wishing to be arrested remaining on site before being removed. Up to 11,000 people visited or took part in the protests, and more than 850 eventually faced court. For most of the action, very little obstruction occurred. However, towards the end of the protest, tree sitting and other actions held up work. Where we pick up the conversation with Paul, he discusses his experiences during this time.
And then in 1993, the massive organized that was sort of giving them the authorities an idea that, look, a certain number of people will show up if it's just ad hoc, but if it gets organized, then, my God, you're really up against it. So after about 800 people had been arrested on the road, getting towards the end of the season, then the tree climbers started. We showed up around September. Now, what was going on at that point, I knew, okay, you can't do two trees. You can't save two trees. It's one tree. But what other people were doing is they were uncomfortable about or didn't know about the possibility of making a little nest. And so what they'd do is they'd drag up a great big platform, and they'd get up on it because they'd like to be on a flat surface, and then they would lock themselves on the platform. But what would happen is that the loggers, and in this case it was probably specialized emergency response team, RCMP officers, they would go up, and because they had taken a crash course in tree climbing, they would go up and they would arrest the person and cut them free from whatever they were, and then they would just belay them out of the tree. If you have a platform, then they can belay you out of the tree. It's only when you go to the very top of the tree that they've got a problem. I call it canopy camping now rather than tree sitting, because if you spend a night and you're up high, because now what it evolved into as if you go to the top of the tree with all your gear and you just set up a little a nest with anywhere that there's two branches that branch out, you can set yourself a thing with fish netting and a folded over hammock and then a foamy, and your sleeping bag is inside that. And then you attach that. It's a V-shaped thing that then attaches to those branches. And then you tie ropes at the end of the branches up to take your weight. And you don't take your harness off, which is still attached to the tree, and you slide into that. What it means is that when they come up after you, you can just gather that all up and go to the very top of the tree. If you go to the top of a healthy tree with a nice, healthy leader, then there's nothing they can do other than get underneath you and arrest your boot, is how I like to put it. Now, at the Bolson, because I arrived at night, I didn't get a good look at tree that I was going to climb. So when I got to the very top of this tree, I'm like, oh, Christ, look at it. It's coppiced and into five dead leaders. Well, and I put up my main huge 110-liter dry bag up there, and I set myself my first little nest and spent a night or two, and then they started coming up after me, and first logger, RCMP officer, who knows. The first one I set up, because I brought multiple ones with me, the first one I set up, I tied it with a whole bunch of little scraps of rope and string, just because I knew they were going to get it. I wanted them to get it. And so he was sitting there picking away at it, trying to figure out how to, you know, get this thing undone. And I was on a very friendly basis, just joke with them, smile at them. Hey, you know, I'm not against you guys. I used to be a logger. I'm not against logging. I just think that this type of logging's not working. Sleeping bag and everything was already at the top of the tree. So what he was trying to get was the fish netting, heavy-duty fish netting thing that was around the two branches. And so he started cutting away and cut, 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 cut. And next thing you know, boom, he drops it. And he looks up at me and goes, whoa, sorry about that. And I said, it's okay. I've got lots more. When you're on the ground, you're so used to dropping something and picking it up. You can't do that when you're out the tree. When you drop it, it's gone. So everything that's valuable that you don't want to lose has to have a little tether tied to it. Anyhow, so a couple days later, he ended up coming up after me all the way to the very top of the tree where I had my dry bag. And I've got a harness at this point. And because the tree didn't have one single leader, he was able to get up beside me. And I'm just kind of going, where's this going? This is crazy. He can't belay me out from this situation. There's nothing higher. There's got to be something higher for him to belay me out. But as soon as he arrived beside me, he had a beaner, carabiner clipped to his harness, and he clipped it into my harness. And so I'm just sitting there looking at this carabiner, and then he's fiddling with something, and I'm just going, this is crazy. So while he was busy, I very slowly undid my harness and slipped myself out of it. And then I said, hey, Mark. And he looks and held it right to his face and said, you want this? Like, you've clipped into it. Obviously, you want my harness. So his eyes just went, blah, and he quit.
Due to your need to attend to some personal business, you eventually came down from the tree after 10 days and snuck out of the area. This wasn't without difficulties, though, was it?
They had hired one of the seven loggers who had chopped me out of a tree. He was the guy that they hired to try to get me out of this tree. And so what happened was he had somehow got hold of my rappel rope and tied it into a massive Gordian knot halfway down the tree. So and then they also had a down below there was a guard who was supposed to keep an eye on me by sneaking down the side of the tree and keeping the tree between myself and him. I was able to untie this Gordian knot and rappel myself down, and then I met my friend who I'd previously met at the Sitka, and we just highballed it down a crazy slope to the Bolson River, and then highballed down the Bolson River, and then I jumped into a boat that was waiting for me, and then I zipped to an island in Clackwood Sound, and I lay low. I was not going to turn myself in. We came back to the urban farm, so now I'm on the urban farm, and the trials are going on for the 900 people. And then I finally called them and I said, look, I've dealt with what I had to deal with. I'm prepared to turn myself in, and I did.
So what did they end up charging you with?
I was charged with endangering a police officer's life because he had to try to get up the tree to get at me. They went to that length, and that spooked me. And so they had also separated me from the other 950 people and put me in a different city by myself. And I was prepared for that, but when they read the charges, I went, don't know about that. And so I asked for a stay of proceeding or continuance and went and checked in with a lawyer.
Despite the increasing severity of charges leveled at blockaders, you and others continued to take direct action against old-growth logging. From 1991 onwards, there'd also been a series of anti-logging blockades and protests in the Walburn and Caramana area, which eventually ended with the government agreeing to protect part of the old-growth forest in 1995. What was your experience of these blockades?
There was quite a bit at the Walburn, 2 or 3 years where there was a lot of activity there, and they didn't have any tree climbers. And what had happened was it was a bridge, and they had their camp on the one side of the bridge. And I realized that if someone could get themselves up in that big cedar with all sorts of spires, dead spires, that they just would not be able to get that person out, because that person could just, like, zip around from dead spire to spire. But trying to get up into a monster cedar when you can't... I didn't have any of the projectile where you shoot a line up over a line and then prosecute your way up, or use ascenders. If you can shoot a line over a branch, it has to be not the first branch but the second branch, then you can ascend your way up. And I didn't have any of that. So what I did is I climbed up one tree, tied a rope, and then went over to another tree and tied the rope and then pulled it tight. And now it was at a point where if I then went out across that that line that was strung between these two trees, then I'd have a chance of getting into the first branch. But what happened, of course, is when I got to the middle of the rope, because I was still using polypropylene, and polypropylene is horrible rope for climbing. That's got to be sailing rope, or Dacron nylon or something like that. That doesn't stretch, because by the time I got to the middle, that branch was 20 feet above me, and I had a hell of a time. I almost didn't make it back to the tree, so that was a really scary experience. And that was when a friend of mine, who was a mountain climber, he arrived, and he and I together, we managed to get into that big cedar. Once we had established getting into the cedar, then it was easy for anyone to get into the cedar, because there was a rope down, could ascend up. So when we left, it was with the idea that, okay, folks, keep someone in this tree and they cannot get you. They cannot do anything. But what happened is somehow a whole bunch of alcohol got, and everyone got drunk, and there was nobody up in the tree, and the loggers came in at 4 o'clock in the morning and they chopped the tree down, and I got kind of like, yikes, can't believe it. All that scary energy to take that tree, and if they had maintained somebody up in that tree, that would not have happened.
Who was usually involved in these and other blockades at the time?
Core of the people that went to the protests in Clackwood Sound were quite different from the people that went to the Walburn. It was almost like the Walburn people were like, this is our back. It's much closer to Victoria, for one thing. The reason why the Carmana and the Nitinat and the West Coast Trail and the Walburn all still exist is because when you come up the west coast of Vancouver Island, it becomes like Norway. It's fjords. And there's a Mont Walbran and Kalite Creek were so intense that they could not continue the road on the coast. To get at the coastline, they had to come in from interior of the island through Lake Cowichan. They went to Lake Cowichan and then came down. So luckily for us, Mont Walbran, which is right at Port Renfrew, you cannot, there's no road. There was, and even the people who defended the Carmana, that was another blockade, I don't know how it goes in that regards that people tend to sort of feel like this is my area, this is where I go. I had more of a sort of a sense of like we've got to make a stand everywhere.
What were some of the other protests you were involved in?
I ended up getting some money from someone who gave me some cash to buy a bunch of equipment, and a friend and I, we took his van and we went to Nelson, the interior of BC. There was a blockade going on there, and we helped the people out there in terms of giving them the equipment and showing them how to use it. And there were other episodes of me going with people to climb trees to put up banners and things like that. And then there were all the tree climbing that I did at the there's a big redwood or a some type of a sequoia or something on the Victoria government lawn. Yep. So I would occasionally just climb to the top of that and put up some balloons in the middle of the night or camp out in it and wake up to a fire ladder. And I'd say, oh no, thank you, I'm fine. Yes, as I'm chatting with the person, as I'm busily packing, saying, no, I'll come down later, I'm okay.
In the early 2000s, there was further blockading against the clear felling of old-growth forest in the Walbran Valley. Most famously, Betty Krasik, then aged 74, was arrested and jailed for 10 months. This came after she defied court orders which were set up to prevent protesters from returning to logging sites after they'd been arrested. And some of these experiences she later detailed in her memoir, Open Living Confidential, from Inside the Joint. What are your memories of this blockade?
Women started to realise that there was a problem with men at blockades, and that men, the combination of testosterone and adrenaline, that men would just sort of, like, get too aggressive. So they formed a group called the Women of the Woods. And the idea behind that was that only women would be in the front line and men were only at the camp in order to support them. So I went up. We were trying to get a woman named Betty Krasik. She was a grandmother and she'd been arrested before. And she was smart because instead of signing the form that would allow you to leave, she wouldn't sign it, and therefore she'd be kept in jail. She, as soon as she was taken in, she didn't get out. She was become like a political prisoner. So they didn't really want to arrest her, so it was pretty tricky to get her arrested.
Given every chance to form a healing circle, to join the living dance of my land, my land. Water's not just the purity. Water's not just the beat, it's the melody of panic. Feeds the life of mine throughout our land, throughout our land.
But every action has an opposite reaction. all the tall trees down, and I hope you understand. By the time your children come of age, they're gonna scream out, they're gonna moan, they're gonna cry for their land. For their
You just heard a song called Land, which was written and recorded by members of the bands The Tragically Hip, Midnight Oil, Crash Vegas, Hothouse Flowers and Daniel Lanois. The show you've been listening to is Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, and today's program is the last in what has been a summer series. To hear more environmental stories and current affairs, tune into Earth Matters on Sundays between 11 a.m. to 11:30 via 3cr.org.au.